Hello, everybody, and I'm very pleased to have back on the show today one of my great guests from South Africa. We've just had a great conversation, and we thought we'd better start recording the show. And this is Stephen Mitford Goodson, and I'm going to bring him up right now. Stephen, are you with me?
Yes. Hello, Andrew. Thank you for having me again.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to come back on. I mean, the last show that we did on the Boers, I mean, that was a joy to do because I love covering history. I really do. And especially if you can get such a complete account as you put together, that anyone who is completely unaware of that subject could literally listen to that show and have a great education in it by the end of it. So that was one of my real favourites. And today, your background essentially is in finance. You're a real expert. And I've got the title of the show, The Trials and Tribulations of Exposing the Central Banking Scam, because this essentially is something that you've done. And so what I'd like to start with is your background into how you got into finance, leading into your experiences that led you to expose this scam, how you exposed it. So if we run through that first, and then we can go into what's happened to you as a result of you know, exposing these people behind the scenes. So go ahead, please.
Yes, well, I first became aware of there being a banking or financial problem quite some while ago. It was in the 1970s while I was living in Rhodesia. I read a journal called Rhodesian Property and Finance, and the editor, Wilfred Brooks, he appeared to be aware of this problem, and he had a column which he reprinted from the Financial Times. It was written by a journalist by the name of C. Gordon Tether. And he wrote about the Bilderbergers and this secret financial group. And funny enough, this journalist was shortly thereafter, he was fired by the editor of the Financial Times, Eddie Fisher. But nonetheless, this pricked my interest, and I started reading up about the various banking systems. And something that had always puzzled me, and that was from when I was at school, history was one of my favorite subjects, and I could never understand what was the cause of World War II. You know, we're told it was because of Germany's invasion of Poland and conquest of that country, but that just didn't seem to add up. And it was only when I found out that Germany had changed its banking system so that it could be free from the international bankers, it could print its own and create its own money, and it was able to conduct at least half its trade by means of barter, thus bypassing the international payment system. And I became aware of the fact that it was for financial reasons that Germany was forced into a war. And a few years later, I pondered the question of Japan. I thought, well, why was Japan forced into World War II? And then I came up with the identical reasons, which were that Japan had adopted the social credit policies of Major C.H. Douglas after a lecture tour in 1929. And they had also introduced a similar system to Germany of creating their own money with their own state bank, and they became enormously prosperous as a result thereof. In Germany's case, the gross domestic product increased by 11% per annum, and in Japan, it was even higher, about 25%. And it's for this reason that these two countries, and Italy as well, which also had a state banking system since 1936, had to be destroyed. So that was my sort of introduction into understanding what was behind the World War II, and the reason was, of course, that they had transgressed the banking system, the fractional reserve system, which had been instituted by the Rothschilds as far back as the beginning of the 19th century.
Yes, and it's funny because you raised the point about, Germany's invasion of Poland at the start of World War II. Well, that was what we were told we had to go into World War II as a result of. And then at the end of World War II, you had Russia or the Soviet Union occupying all of the east of that country, and there was no requirement for us to have any further war to return that to Poland. So I think that you can look at history and see what Henry Ford said, that it's bunk, and it's just what they want to tell us. But certainly, I mean, if you talk us through the roles that you had in finance that gave you the information, because I understand that you were, I think that your position was not renewed or something. I don't think you were directly forced out. Can you go through that for us, please?
Well, at the time when I was in Rhodesia, I was working for a merchant bank, and I had a number of positions as a portfolio manager, investment manager of investment portfolios. And I worked for life assurance companies, a short-term insurer, and a stockbroker. So that gave me a sort of a background of how the finance system works. In 1999, I, with a few friends, established a political party, the Abolition of Income Tax and Usury Party, which took part in the national elections. In South Africa, we don't have individual constituencies. It's all based on proportional representation, which actually gives small parties a better chance of getting a representative. As it turned out, we didn't have much in the way of finance to spread our message, but we obtained just under 11,000 votes, which we would have needed a minimum of 20,000 in order to secure the seat. And there were, of the 16 parties, we finished not bottom, but we did finish three from the bottom. We were in front of the Socialist Workers' Party and the Greens Party. So that was a sort of the reason why I was pursuing a political route was not to take up politics as such, but to use it as a platform in which to promote monetary reform and bring it to the attention of the general public. In the following years, I took part in a few local government elections in Cape Town, three of them, and then in 2014, that's in the last general election, I joined up with the Ubuntu Party, which is under the leadership of Michael Tellinger, and I was the second candidate. And we promoted a people's or state bank to take over the functions of the existing central bank. And we had a very enthusiastic campaign. We had almost 1,000 people in the field. You know, we printed T-shirts. We did. We translated our message into various indigenous languages. We used a trailer with a big placard. We put up posters all over the country. It was a tremendous campaign, and but we got very little return, and I believe that our votes were severely diminished. The ballot papers are tallied in each voting district, and then the figures are sent to a central database in Pretoria where they're all collated, and obviously that opens up the opportunity for malfeasance. And we know that we were definitely cheated out of one or two seats. In one case, it's referred to the overseas ballots, and there was a representative there, and he noticed that I think there were about 16,000 votes were cast, and we had 4,000. That's a quarter of them. And we actually saw the power, but when we got our final tally, we received less than 8,000 votes throughout the country, so we knew that we had been targeted. But that comes as no surprise, and most voting systems are tainted in all democracies, you know, whether it be the United States or France or anywhere else. So that was the sort of that was the political approach to propagandizing the idea of monetary reform. Then, Yes, well, then in since 1986, I've been a shareholder of the South African Reserve Bank, and it is one of eight central banks in the world which has a private shareholding, and in the case of South Africa, half the directors are elected every year. Not necessarily all seven of them, but one or three, depending on whose period of office had expired. And this offered an opportunity to present oneself as a candidate. If you didn't even be a shareholder. So I, what actually encouraged me to put myself up for election was that I'd made a proposal, a special resolution, that the bank should increase the dividend, which had been fixed since 1921 at 10 cents per share, and it had obviously it, been greatly devalued by inflation over the years, and that this should be adjusted. And this was well received by the shareholders. And I thought, well, seeing that I'm putting this resolution up, I might as well make myself available as a director. And my opponent at that time was the recently retired CEO of the largest mining company in the world, a BHP Billiton, Brian Gilbertson. And contrary to their expectations, I received, well, the resolution received 75% of the votes, and I received a similar number, a similar percentage. And that's how I became elected as a director of the Reserve Bank. I was elected for 3 years, and I took the what I thought the most prudent option was not to be controversial or to rock the boat, as it were, and I merely simply applied myself to learning the rules and to making a contribution. And that was accepted. Initially, they did try to introduce legislation to have me excluded, but they dropped that. And by the time at the end of the three-year period, I was invited to carry out to make myself available for a further three-year term. And that was repeated after 6 years. And then in my last period of office, I did try to introduce a memorandum for the board to discuss about reforming the South African Reserve Bank so that it could operate on state banking lines, whereby the Reserve Bank would issue all the country's currency, in other words, nationalizing the money supply. And I drew up this memorandum and cited numerous examples of where it had worked in the past and the present, but this proposal was not understood by the current governor then, Jill Marcus. She referred it to the senior economist, and he did not understand it, and so the matter just never went forward. And so I left after my third term, as we're only allowed to serve three terms, and that was where my career at the Reserve Bank ended.
Yes, and I understand that you've been under attack since then by various groups on things you have written about the central banking scam. First, can you tell people in as simple terms as possible what the core of the central banking scam is?
Well, the model central bank is the Bank of England, which was established on the 27th of July, 1694, and that model has been replicated throughout the world. But central banks didn't take off initially. It was a long gestation period, and the next one was in America. The American colonies, they issued their own currency, a form of colonial scrip, which didn't carry interest and was debt-free. And it was this colonial currency which drew the attention of the Bank of England, and they realized that they were losing control over the American colonies, and so they instructed the colonies to import their currency from England, and this was not done effectively. In fact, they didn't get the amounts they needed, and this caused a huge slump in North America and huge unemployment, and was the principal cause of the American Revolution. You know, the war ended in 1783, and already 2 years prior to that, a Bank of North America had been set up, which was a central bank modeled on the Bank of England. And this bank was replaced in 1791 by the First Bank of the United States, a largely foreign-controlled central bank. And once again, its banner was not renewed after 20 years in 1811, but it was a second bank of the United States was established in 1816. So central banks did not really come into operation on a large scale during the 19th century, and that in 1900 there were only 18 countries which had adopted central banks. And most of them were in Europe, but there were also central banks in Japan, United States, Indonesia, and the rest were all in Europe. It was only after World War I, which was partly fought to destroy all the major empires of Austria, Germany, Russia, and Turkey, to all to split them up into smaller states, which would be more easily amenable to the setting up of central banks. And there was a conference in Genoa in March, April 1922, where this whole matter was discussed by the governors of the central banks of France, Britain, Germany, and America. And it was decided that all countries should have a central bank. And the purpose of a central bank, ostensibly, is to, you know, print the notes and mint the coin, and to supervise the banks and to ensure that there's stability in the economy. But that is really only a small part of their overall responsibilities. The principal reason you have a central bank is so that it can permit the commercial banks to create the country's currency as an interest-earning debt. And this is why one of the principal objects of central banking is to undermine the power of governments and to allow all power to rest with the commercial banks. One of the pillars of central banking is well known, is that they must be independent, and this independence allegedly enables them to act in a neutral way, but that is simply not the truth. They are independent of governments and their people, but they're not independent of the commercial banks. And it's an example of the tail wagging the dog. And the central banks are there to serve the interests of the private banks and to allow them to create all the money except for the notes and coin, and to therefore enrich themselves and their owners to a really fabulous extent.
Yes, and the traditional, well, I don't know if that's even the right word, what we were told was the traditional fractional reserve banking model was that these commercial banks could lend out 20 times what they had on deposit. And so and feel free to jump in if I'm wrong here, but the example I would give is if they had £1,000, then they could lend out 20. But if they've only got £1,000, where do they get that 20 from? Do they go to the central bank and say, we've got this on deposit, so we want you to print up another 20,000 and then lend that up out? Can you explain the process here, please?
Well, what happens is that a private bank will be required to deposit funds, liquid funds, cash or treasury bills, sometimes government, short-dated government stock, with the central bank. And they will earn interest on that money. So, for example, if they've got £100 million on deposit, then they can lend out £1 billion. So how it works is very simple. All that happens is that, for example, if you go to a commercial bank and ask for a housing loan, and I don't know the situation in England, but I would imagine that housing loans form, well, I know in South Africa they form 50% of their loan book and probably a similar amount in England, possibly even more, 70%. So this is a very cogent example. You go to the bank and you ask, you want to buy a house for £1 million, and the bank will check your employment references, your income stream, and so forth. And if they feel that you are capable of repaying the capital plus the interest and other sundry charges, they will grant you a loan. Now, in the mind of the borrower, you are now asking the bank to transfer £1 million from Joe Smith's savings account to your loan, to your mortgage account. And the bank will charge you, for example, 5% on your loan, and the person you're borrowing from, his savings account, he will be getting, so we say, 3%. So that 2% would represent the margin of profit which the commercial bank is making on the loan. But it doesn't actually work like that. All the bank does is it credits your account with £1 million. So in the bank's balance sheet, it will now have an asset of £1 million. But now where's the liability? And this is where the creation process comes into effect. They create a deposit of £1 million out of thin air. And then their books balance. They've got a fictional deposit of £1 million and an actual, which is a liability, and they have an asset of £1 million which they have lent to the borrower. And then and they will obviously then charge interest on that money. And the general experience is that during the life, if should we say that, for example, that borrower bought that house when he was at the age of, say, 25. During his lifetime, the borrower will pay about five times the initial amount he paid for the house in interest and expense and sundry costs. And this is how the banks suck out the wealth of the individual and the entire population. And it also works with other types of loans, for, you know, car loans or whatever, and the same principle applies with governments. Although governments sometimes will tap into the existing pool of money, but that money still has been created out of nothing. So governments will borrow, shall we say, at currently the rates are quite low, 4%. But then in order to fund the payment of that interest, they will have to tax the people to pay that interest to the bankers. So the bankers have literally, because they control the money supply, they control the government and its people.
Now, how about in the case of, because obviously with a mortgage now, you say they create this fictional deposit, and then that presumably, when the house is purchased, that money gets sent to the seller's bank, etc. But how about if you've got a situation where somebody's got a loan for £5,000 and they go into the bank and they just want the £5,000 in cash because they're off to a used car salesman around the corner and they're going to give him £5,000 cash for a car. Where do they actually get, because of course they've got to then physically give you the money.
Yes. Well, I mean, they do have a small percentage of their assets available for dealing with customer requirements. Obviously, they don't. That money they have not created themselves. That money has been printed by the Bank of England. And they pay for that money. They have to pay for the and when those banknotes become soiled or unusable, then they get that money refunded. So in that particular case, they would actually have to pay for physical cash. But you must remember that only 3% of all transactions are in cash. So those disbursements of cash will not really impact on their profitability, because the other 97%, that money has been created by them out of nothing. So an example you've given, while it is true that the bank doesn't create that cash out of nothing, it's not a loss, but they don't gain anything from that particular transaction.
Yes, it's very interesting, because you see, a lot of people think that the model is that the central bank could just keep printing lots and lots of money, a commercial bank goes to them and then they can say, we've got this loan and you'll print the money up and what have you. But essentially what you're saying is that certainly when it's on an electronic or even on the old check basis, that as soon as they've got that loan, then they just pretend that they've got the exact equivalent on deposit when they haven't. It's only when they require cash transactions that they have to actually go and get the money, and they essentially won't make anything on that. So that's a fascinating example that you've given us, a fascinating bit of knowledge, because essentially it really shows that when people say that this bank just creates that money, so you're talking about every commercial bank, so in the UK, if you're going to go to Barclays or HSBC or Lloyds or what have you, then this is how they will do it when you're getting a mortgage, for example. And the other thing is, of course, we keep seeing this great big push for cashless society. There was a story recently in the UK, Steve, and they want to encourage people to stop paying anyone in cash, maybe your window cleaner, what have you, because he might not pay tax on that money, you know, and we want everything recorded. But it goes to show the level of the greed of these banks, because they're obviously identifying this 3% that they don't want to lose out on, and they're desperate to have that all in cash, and they're doing all sorts of things like that new contactless payment, you know, rather than putting your card in the machine and typing in the PIN, you can have a little chip and you just like dangle it somewhere. And I wouldn't do that at all, because I would be worried that if I went too close to one of these, it might just take money. I'd rather have the security of having a PIN number. But they're pushing all these different things. There's a company in Wisconsin I read about recently. There's some tech company, and they're pushing microchips for their employees. If they want them, it'll go in the skin between your thumb and forefinger, and you just scan that to get through doors and also to make payments in the staff canteen, etc., etc. All these things are on the way. And it's interesting that you said essentially that the cash element is something they're not making on, and so that's another reason why they want to get rid of it. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yes. Well, although only 3% of the actual cash or the money in circulation created is cash, 30% of transactions are still done by means of cash. That's between you and me and shops and so forth. That's excluding the banks. And the reason why they want to have a cashless society is obviously they can then monitor your spending patterns, but they can extract a sort of permanent source of income even if they're debit cards, because they take a percentage of the sales price on every transaction. And I know for credit cards, they can charge a merchant up to 10%, depending on the viability of the business. And this money is actually is being ripped off from the consumer. Whereas if we had an honest money system, we could have, it would only be necessary to charge, shall we say, a fifth of a percent just to run the system. But instead, they charge, generally, they will take, well, obviously for the big supermarkets and so forth, the charge is probably only around about a percent. But for other merchants, they will charge anything from 2 to 5%. And this is money, for them, this is money for old rope. And that's one of the principal reasons why they want to have a cashless society. It also suits them because cash is cumbersome. I mean, you have to have, you know, extraordinary security arrangements for transferring it from various depots and so forth. But that does will have a slight downside for the central bank, something which they seem to have ignored, because when a central bank prints money, physical cash, it then sells it to the commercial banks, who then distribute it to the public. But they don't own that cash. The cash that they've sold to the private banks, they then invest that money, and the interest on that money helps to defray their running costs. So if they're going to diminish the issue of cash, this is a major part of their income, is going to be severely reduced. So they will have to find some other form of income in order to fund their operations.
Right, and of course in America it's very revealing, the fact that, I mean, we know the story of the Federal Reserve, the banks that own it, the people behind those banks, and the fact that if you look up a phone book under Federal, and you look for Federal Reserve, it's not in the government section of the phone book, it's in the private section near Federal Express, for example. But in the UK, we're told that the Bank of England was nationalised, and so now the government owns it. What's the story there? Is it still owned by these? Because I always was led to believe that in order to nationalise it, you have to essentially buy it from someone who owns it. They never just, unless it's in communist Soviet times, when they'll just seize people's property. In the UK, they would have to buy it off the original owners. And I understand that what they did was they had to give them so many bonds that these people still essentially retained control of it, and the change was in name only. Can you clarify what the story is there and who actually does have the power over the Bank of England, please, Stephen?
Well, in 1946, this was part of Labour's nationalisation program. The Bank of England was nationalised, and the shareholders were paid out in bonds at, I think it was 12% at that time, and they were redeemed after 20 years. Of course, nationalising the Bank of England meant absolutely no difference, just like there now moves to nationalise the South African Reserve Bank. All that has changed is the ownership, but not the management and the structures. They remain the same. So that nationalisation was a sort of a symbolic act which made absolutely no difference to the lives of the people who were still under the control of the private banks. I believe later on in the 70s or 80s, there was talk of there having been a reverse nationalisation of the Bank of England, but I do mention in my book A History of Central Banking, but it's not exactly clear who actually owns the Bank of England today.
Thank you for telling me that, because I banging my head against a brick wall with that one when I was doing my research many years ago, and I heard many people, it was secretly bought back or what have you, and I couldn't get to the bottom of that story. But essentially what you've said to us is, okay, say it was bought back, and so when he went through the way that central banks make money by printing money, one of them, and that's how they maintain their, you know, costs and what have you. That's not where the real rip-off is taking place. The real rip-off is the person getting the loan for a bit of £1 billion and the bank just saying that they've automatically got £1 billion on deposit, which they haven't got. And this takes us to the story that we hear, that if everybody went to a bank in one day to get their money out in cash, that that bank would fold. But then when you look at the small print and that now, if you, for example, wanted to withdraw money from a cash point machine, then they limit you to, you know, I think it depends obviously on your bank, it could be anywhere from £250-£300 a day. I think some banks give you £500 or something by special arrangement. And then also, if you look into the small print of how much money can I withdraw each day from a branch, and they generally limit you to about £500. And so they've got all these limits in place to ensure that that nightmare scenario does not take place. I've never actually seen that really happen. I mean, obviously, we could look at, you know, situations, you know, in the war in Germany, we have those stories about people, someone taking a basket full of money to buy a loaf of bread, and someone stole the basket but left the money. Is there any examples of how the public have managed to actually bankrupt a bank through withdrawals alone?
Well, that was very prevalent in the United States, where they had tens of thousands of banks, you know, in the 19th century, early 20th century. And there were numerous runs on banks when there was the belief that they had run out of cash or run out of gold coin. And so, you know, that's you know, that was very prevalent. But today, the thing is, you know, the system is much tighter. And if any bank should experience a run, then the others will quickly rally around, and as well as the central bank, and they'll supply all the liquidity they need in order to stave off that run. So in today, in the modern world, that rarely occurs.
Yes, and that's very interesting. So let's have an example of those. Is it just a case... So we're going back to like the depression in the 30s and the bank runs, etc. in America. So once that bank is exhausted, they can just say, right, we've gone bust. So anyone who didn't get their money out, well, you've lost it. Bye bye. Is that essentially what happened there?
Yes, you lost your deposits or whatever you had with the bank. And I mean, there were about over 10,000 banks went bust in the early 1930s. Thereafter, they set up the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which I think today it insures deposits up to $100,000, and that is a sort of kind of a safety net, and it has been used in the past. There were a number of banks, like the Franklin Bank was one of them in the 80s that went bust, and they bail out the depositors were bailed out. Of course, that having such a safety net that also creates the problem of moral hazard, that people will behave recklessly, and talk about banks, because they know that the safety net will be in there. But the banks actually have to pay for it. They have to contribute to it. So I believe most countries do have a similar arrangement, so that if a bank should fall into difficulties, the depositors and savers will be bailed out, and the central banks have always tried to protect the depositors in order to sort of save face and keep the system going, but for the shareholders that usually means that they've lost all their money.
Now, going back to the 1930s, so the bank run happens, the bank goes bust, any depositors have lost their deposit, end of story. How about anyone who had a mortgage with that bank that went bust, as there was no bank to keep paying, if they'd have just got a mortgage, did they end up with a free house?
Well, what often happened is those bust banks were taken over by other banks, and they would have... Because they would have sold whatever. I mean, when a bank goes bust, they still, although their net balance sheet is negative, they will still have assets. And what would happen in a case like that is that a bigger bank would have taken over those assets, would have paid a dollar for the bank, and then would have kept the assets of the bank and let the liabilities would have just fallen away. So, I don't think he would have got a free house.
But it's a really important point, isn't it, to look at, because, you know, I've said that before. It's just ridiculous. The new bank can just take something over and cherry pick all the profitable bits off it and have absolutely no obligation to the people that lost money with that bank. It's just
happened with Lehman Brothers when they went bust. I mean, all the good parts were taken over by various other banks. I think Barclays even took over a portion of Lehman Brothers. But the shareholders and others who were invested, they lost everything.
Well, it makes you wonder if they all get together and they say, right, we've got a load of bad liabilities here and you've got those here. And so what we'll do is we'll gradually funnel them all to Lehman Brothers. We'll bust that. And then we'll cherry pick the bits that we want, and we therefore, survive without these horrible liabilities. Do you think that's very possible?
Oh, indeed, I'm sure it happens all the time.
Yeah, it's just they won't give. They're so greedy. They won't just say, well, the bank went bust, so the deposits we can't pay the depositors. But if you just got a house for these people, you're lucky. It's like, no, we'll make sure that we get everything, every little avenue they've got covered in order to, and it all is based upon the fact that they create money out of thin air, and it's the commercial banks that are allowed to do it. And this, was this 20%, being allowed to loan out 20 times what you had on deposit, was that ever true, or was it just used as an example?
Yes, no, it was definitely true. It was, in fact, up to 1989 in Japan, they only had to have 2%. You could borrow 50 times. And that was when they introduced the Basel I regulations, which changed it to 10%. And that's why Japan was precipitated into a recession from which it really has never recovered. As a result of the fiasco in 2007-2008, in March 2019, under the Basel III regulations, the reserves which a private bank must hold with the central bank have been increased to 14%. That has actually, although it seems like it's a good move to tighten up the lending system, the downside is that less money is going to be created, and the whole money supply is predicated on banks creating new loans. Because when a loan is repaid or simply reneged on, that means that money is being withdrawn from the system. And that's why we have this constant growth mania. We've got to grow, we've got to lend money in order to keep the money supply up. If we don't do that, then there will be a deflation. So that was one of the reasons why they lent all this money out after 2008 to all the banks to pump up their balance sheets at very favorable rates of interest of 1% or whatever. But the consumer didn't benefit from that, and that's why growth, so-called, has been anemic over the last 10 years. And it's because the banks cannot create more money for loans because there's not a sufficient demand.
Yeah, I was just running through this in my mind, because on the amount that they have to have on deposit before they can make loans, if someone comes into the bank and they want to borrow £1 million for a house, so they agree, and then they lend them the million, and they just write that they've had an invisible deposit of a million. And then the next person comes in, he wants the same thing, the next person, then every time that they're lending out a million, they're also giving themselves an invisible deposit of a million. And so essentially, it's only going to be the cash reserves, wouldn't it, that are dependent on this, what you gave the example of the 14% that you have to have on reserve, because all the other money, every time that they're giving it out, they're saying that they got a deposit of that amount.
Yes. They can create up to 10 times, well, a bit less under the 14% rule. That also depends on the kind of asset that you're talking about. Currently, the existing system where the average must be 10%, for property is only 7%, and that will increase to 10% from March 2019.
Yes, and that would be another indicator of why the house prices in the UK have been pushed up and up and up and up and up. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. You know, now the average salary in the UK is about 25,000, and the average house price is about 220,000. So, you know, you're talking about over, well, nearly nine times, basically, your salary. And this is nine times the average salary for the average property. It's absolute lunacy. But of course, they need to keep doing that because they need all this money. And the only way that the banks can stay afloat is when someone comes in, essentially a mortgage is what they want to give out, something where they can, or a personal loan in which the individual's just sending the money somewhere else electronically because it's just something that they created out of nothing. And so it makes sense for the banks to you know, encourage inflation. And now we're in a situation, though, where the interest rates, as you pointed out earlier in the show, are so low because they've pushed everything up so high. So they can't push it too much more because people won't be able to afford anything because the employers aren't paying. And it makes me wonder if these FDIC regulations, I think in the UK it's something like £80,000. So that would be similar now to about $100,000 because the pound and the dollar are quite a bit closer together than they were since Brexit. So we keep hearing about a potential crash coming up because of this quantitative easing, or QE they've changed it to and what have you, where they just keep printing more and more money. What are your views on that? Is there a crash imminent? Go through that for us, please.
Well, I mean, a crash has been predicted for, well, certainly since 1971, when America went off the gold exchange standard. But, you know, these central banks and their ultimate controlling bank, the Bank for International Settlements, have been very deft at deferring any such circumstance happening. At present, it's obvious that this quantitative easing has boosted the money supply, but it hasn't boosted economic growth. And the problem arises now is that when they get off this quantitative easing, when they stop creating money, and interest rates rise, then we're going to have a major problem, and that could precipitate a major slump. You know, if you look over, I mean, the U.S. debt is almost from the time when Obama was elected in 2008, the U.S. debt doubled from 9 trillion to 18 trillion. And, you know, this doubling of every 8 or 10 years is unsustainable because eventually the interest payable on this debt will consume more than half the budget. So there's obviously a cap to this. This can't just go, you know, it's unsustainable, and eventually it will cease. And as it stands, the stock exchange is hopelessly overvalued. It's bloated. And if you look on the price-earnings ratio, I mean, it's well above the average of, I think it's 27, the average is about 15, but if you take the 10-year average, it's even worse. So definitely there is, you know, something brewing, but as I say, they've been very skillful in the past in avoiding a major calamity. But it may be not that far off away.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like Yellowstone. You know, it could go at any time, but it's kept going all this time without erupting. It's literally, you could equate it to something like that. I mean, if they keep producing, why would they stop producing this money if it's serving their purpose? And it's like, well, you know, this debt's there and this debt's getting bigger and what have you. Well, the bankers depend on debt. The most important thing to a banker is not to pay the principal, just to keep paying the interest.
Yes.
So, you know, we will see in time. But we've got a few minutes left, and I'm conscious. I mean, this has just been, you know, has absolutely taken the cake for me for an easy to understand way that the banking system works. And I hope that the listeners appreciate it as much as I do, because it really has been useful and it's clarified things for me. As what you said, it's the commercial banks that are doing the printing of money, because people always say, oh, it's the Federal Reserve that's doing it, it's the Bank of England, but you've really, and of course they're printing money, they're printing physical currency, but that's really nugatory when you compare it to the electronic currency that's printed, or currency paid by cheque or anything like that, that they just write that deposit and a bank on the street, your Barclays, your HSBC, can just do that. But you've come under attack, and the title of this show is The Trials and Tribulations, and this is based upon, can you run through what has happened to you? Who has been attacking you? What these attacks have involved against you? Just to let the listeners know who the bad guys really are out there and what they're trying to shut you up from saying.
Yes, well, about 3 months ago, I was contacted by the public protector. She wanted to, well, she asked me if I could assist with a investigation into a banking scandal which took place between 1985 and 1995. And I wrote back and said, look, unfortunately, I wasn't at the Reserve Bank during that time, and you know, I'm unable to give any first-hand information, but you know, thanks for contacting me. But then a few days later, I was contacted again by assistants, and said, no, please, you would like to meet me, which I duly did, and she told me that she'd read my book, Inside the South African Reserve Bank, Its Origins and Secrets Exposed, which, by the way, is available on Amazon. She said she found it a very interesting book, and that she would like to introduce the monetary reform proposals contained in that book. So I was quite taken aback, but she was genuine, and she seemed to have grasped the essentials. And you know, we discussed various aspects, and then you know, we had a bit of correspondence and so forth, and we didn't actually agree, but what seemed to be the way forward was that the public protector would discuss it with her, with other government colleagues, and that they would you know, take the matter forward, possibly towards the end of the year when the African National Congress has its its annual get-together, and I thought that was where the matter would rest. But when she issued her report on the 19th of June, she mentioned, about the claim for the money which was stolen many years ago by a former subsidiary of Absa Bank. And also, she said that the mandate of the central bank should be changed from merely protecting the value of the currency and in the interest of sustainable growth, but rather to promote the growth in the economy in the interest of the people. And she was severely attacked by the central bank and other bankers and the media, which sort of acted in unison. And she did, I don't say unfortunately, but she quoted me as a source in her report. And the media latched onto this, and they tried to present me as being a, you know, someone whose ideas are not acceptable, and that she had been unwise to consult with me. And it seems now that she is going to withdraw that proposal. The central bank instituted a review of her decision, and it is going to court. And of course, Absa Bank disputed her allegations that they still owed money. And as I say, I was subject to numerous, you know, personal attacks in the media, and you know, as a result of my association with her report. And it just went on for a couple of weeks, but it sort of died down now.
Right, well, that's very interesting. And did it make the mainstream media, these attacks on you directly, your name directly?
Oh, yes, no, it was in all the major newspapers, and it was mentioned on radio and also television. But no one ever consulted me or asked for my opinion. You know, it was just taken as read that my point of view wasn't worthy of any inclusion, except for about 9 days ago, I was invited on a talk program for half an hour. It's one of the major TV stations invited me, and I was able there to express my views. It's if anyone wants to look it up, it's called Straight Talk. It was on the 16th of July, and you just type in my name, and you can, Stephen Goodson, and you can just listen to it if you're interested. It'll give you some interesting background as to what it's all about, and the role of the central bank, and what needs to be done to reform it.
Excellent, and I will include a link to that. I've made a note, and also a link to your book. Give the full title, Inside the South African Reserve Bank, Its Origins and Secrets Exposed. I'll give a link to that on Amazon.com. Is there any other website?
And also a history of central banking, because it is a companion volume,
okay,
which actually helps one to understand the Reserve Bank book better. If you've had that, you know, if you've read that book, both book, I mean, the history of central banking has just been updated. And I've just finished the German translation of that book has just been completed.
And so that would be the Amazon.de site. So I know I get some listeners,
yes,
over in Germany. And is it best to go direct to Amazon, or do you have a particular website that you offer it through as well? Or?
No, it's only available at the present. It's only available at Amazon,
okay,
or Barnes and Noble, or I mean, you know, you can look around.
Yeah.
And you could probably find in some bookshops too if you inquire.
Yeah, and one of my listeners, David over in Australia, he recently ordered a book by a guest I had on. He just went to his local bookshop and just ordered it through there. So, you know, that is still, if you've got a bookshop that's connected to the global channels, whatever they are, then they can always get hold of these items.
Yes, well, Amazon through Ingram's is represented in the UK, North America, Australia, New Zealand.
Right, that's interesting. Now, is there anything else? Can I hand back to you for a closing statement? Anything else you'd like to promote? Anything that you'd like to tell the audience? And then we can wrap the show up.
Yes, well, I think we're living in very interesting times, to use that cliche. And I do believe that as the economic crisis unfolds, it's going to create more awareness and also more opportunities. I believe although the internet has its downsides, it has helped in creating more awareness of what is going on. And I believe this is probably our best chance of trying to wrest control back from the bankers who have been controlling us now for more than two centuries. And certainly if we don't take the initiative, we can look to a very bleak future.
Yes, and just one thing that came to my mind, Stephen, is of course all this mass immigration that we're having pushed into Europe. These people would be in a position at some point, if they're going to get employment, to be able to go to a bank and say, I've got a job, give me some money, and then they can carry on their scam with these people. Is that one of the reasons you think that the mass immigration is taking place?
Well, the mass immigration relates really back to the decolonization, which started in 1960. Prior to 1960, Africa was one of the more prosperous areas of the world. I mean, there was no shortage of food. There was, there was prosperity. But after the bankers decided to get rid of the colonial powers, they opted for the option of exploiting them through international loans. And they've done it very effectively, so that many countries spend 100% of their export earnings on paying interest. And this, of course, has largely undermined their economies and brought about the lack of prosperity and the need for people to immigrate and find greener pastures.
Excellent. And I want to thank Monica Stone at the end of this show for pointing out situations, etc., in South Africa and the situation that you were under. And this has just been a fantastic show on central banking. And I watched the Money Masters film several times, but for me, you've explained it in the simplest way I've ever heard today. So thank you so much for joining me today, Stephen.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew, and I hope to be on your show again.
Yes, and Stephen is one of the board of contributing editors of the Barnes Review. There's only a few. Indeed, Stephen, you're always welcome. Just shoot me an email, what have you, and we'll do a show on anything that you'd like to discuss.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right, well, that's the show for today, folks. So I want to thank everyone for listening. I'll be back with you all soon. And bye for now.